This program is brought to you by RTS on iTunes U at the virtual campus of Reformed Theological Seminary. To listen to other courses or to access other materials from RTS, please visit us at itunes.rts.edu. For information on how you may obtain a fully accredited Master of Arts in Religion degree online, please visit us at virtual.rts.edu.
The next section is the Toledot of Noah, 6:9, and it talks about the flood. The theme of this section, although God judges the world because of sin, he gives humanity a new start with the promise to preserve the world. If you remember in Genesis 1, we had movement toward, we can call it chaos, tohu vavohu. Genesis 1, we had movement from chaos to a cosmos, something that was inhabitable for humanity. With the flood, you're going to have it going in the opposite direction. We're going from a very ordered world back to a chaotic, watery existence. There are some interesting parallels between Genesis 1 and the flood account. You remember in Genesis 1, God saw everything and it was what? Very good. You go back to Genesis 6:5, it says, the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great. So he saw everything good in Genesis 1. Now he sees the wickedness of man is great. You had the role of the Holy Spirit, the Spirit, in Genesis chapter 1. Remember, hovering above the waters. The Spirit is mentioned again here in 6:3. My Spirit shall not strive with man forever, for he is indeed flesh. You have the Spirit hovering over the waters in Genesis 1, and that's going to lead to order and a world that is inhabitable for man. Now you have sort of God saying, my Spirit's not going to strive with man. You almost get the idea that it's going to be withdrawn, so that these chaotic conditions are going to return. You have in the flood the unleashing of these waters that in Genesis 1 had receded. God had separated these waters and dry land had appeared. And now in the flood, you have the unleashing of these waters as creation, in a sense, becomes uncreation. At least chaos returns. The world is covered by the waters of the flood. The land is covered. All life outside the ark perishes. But then, after the flood, making a long story short, you have what we might call recreation, but I don't mean that in the sense that God recreates the world like he did in Genesis 1. He created the world in Genesis 1. But you have the floodwaters abating, and you have the earth coming back to the condition, not exactly, there are some changes, but coming back to the condition that it was in Genesis chapter 1. And so in chapter 8, you have the Ruach reappearing, the Spirit, which is usually translated wind. You have to understand that the term Ruach can mean spirit, can mean wind. In Genesis 8:1, it's translated wind by most translations, but the Ruach appears again as the floodwaters are abating. In chapter 8, there's a separation of the land and the sea again, and the dry land appears again in chapter 8, verse 14. There is the renewal of the divine order to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth, chapter 8, verse 17. So the mandate originally given is renewed in 8:17. God guarantees that the order of creation, the regularity of creation, will now continue. At the end of chapter 8, the earth will remain, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, winter and summer, day and night, they shall not cease. God says, I will never destroy the world again through a flood. He may use fire, but he's not going to use a flood. And so the regularity of creation reappears. And you've probably heard the covenant with Noah. We'll talk about covenants in a little bit. But the rainbow, many make the point that God hangs up his bow. We're no longer at warfare with God. And so, you know, the bow is hanging upside down, bow and arrow type thing. He hangs it up now so that we're no longer at war in this way. Never again will I curse the ground for man's sake. There are some interesting parallels between Adam and Noah. Noah is almost a second Adam, armed with Adam's mandate, but it's clear here in Genesis chapter 9, he's operating in a fallen world. So you have the whole marriage, be fruitful and multiply, in chapter 9, verse 1, restated, which would be related to the marriage ordinance in Genesis chapters 1 and 2. You have the dominion concept restated, chapter 9, verse 2, where it's restated, but it's clearly it's the context of a fallen world, because now it says, the fear of you and the dread of you shall be on every beast of the earth, on every bird of the air, and on all that move on the earth. So there's still the dominion mandate. Verse 3 goes on, every moving thing that lives shall be food for you. I've given you all things, even as the green herbs. So there's still that dominion mandate, but it's a fallen world. There's the fearfulness of the animals towards human beings. You have the divine image recur in this passage. Genesis 1, obviously God created us in let us make man in our image. You have the divine image reappearing here in the context of a fallen world. In Genesis 9, 6 and 7, whoever sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed. Why? For in the image of God he made man. And so because we are made in the image of God, it is a very serious thing to take the life of another human being, to murder another human being who is also created in the image of God. And many would argue, and I agree, the foundation of capital punishment and maybe even government may rest in these passages. Well, the fallen world also includes sin. Noah sins, at least many would argue. Look at chapter 9. And I'm going to ask maybe somebody read it loudly so the web people, so I can save my voice just a little bit. I'm feeling pretty good voice-wise. But if someone would read for us, might as well read 9:20 through 27. Might as well get that whole passage before us. Any volunteer to read loudly? Go ahead, sir.
Noah, man of the soil, proceeded to plant a vineyard. When he drank some of the wine, he became drunk and lay uncovered inside his tent. Ham, the father of Canaan, saw his father's nakedness and told his two brothers outside. But Shem and Japheth took a garment and laid it across their shoulders, and they walked in backward and covered their father's nakedness. Their faces were turned the other way so that they would not see their father's nakedness. When Noah awoke from his wine and found out what his youngest son had done to him, he said, "Cursed be Canaan, the lowest of slaves will he be to his brothers." He also said, "Blessed be the Lord, the God of Shem. May Canaan be the slave of Shem. May God extend the territory of Japheth. May Japheth live in the tents of Shem, and may Canaan be his slave."
That's the passage. After the flood, Noah plants a vineyard and begins to drink of some of the fruits of that vineyard. I should probably at least mention, it's not argued by very many people, but there is an article in the book The Way of Wisdom, which is the Feshrif for Bruce Waukee. The article is by Walter Brown. And he argues that Noah does not do anything wrong in this passage. And that the word for drunk is a word that can mean satiated or very content. And so you could get a picture of somebody who is very content, goes into his tent, lays down to sleep, and in the middle of the night, he becomes uncovered, which can happen. And so that particular view would argue that Noah does not necessarily do anything wrong here. Others, probably most, would argue, as this is translated, that Noah drinks of the wine and becomes drunk. Maybe he has too much to drink. Too much, really, from the curse, maybe. Goes into his tent and becomes uncovered in his tent. The key issue is really not what Noah does. You know, whether he is drunk and is uncovered in his tent, or whether he's just very content and becomes uncovered in his tent. That's not really the issue of this passage. The issue of this passage is related to what his son does. It's related to what Ham does. Ham sees the nakedness of his father and then tells his two brothers outside. Now, what is it that Ham did wrong? That's the question. I do not believe there's any hint of a sexual relationship. Now, it does say in verse 21, Noah drank of the wine and was drunk and became uncovered in his tent. We get over to Leviticus 18, and there is a Hebrew phrase, to uncover the nakedness of, that does refer to a sexual relationship, but that's not the same phrase that's used here. And plus, Noah's the only one in the tent when he becomes uncovered and he's sleeping. So I don't think there's any sexual contact or relationship going on here. Some put the emphasis on the fact that Ham saw his father's nakedness. And they would argue that this is not a harmless or an accidental seeing, but they would say that there seems to be some kind of voyeurism involved. Maybe some kind of homosexual voyeurism involved. Habakkuk 2:15 connects drunkenness with voyeurism. Woe to him who gives drink to his neighbors till they are drunk, so that he can gaze on their naked bodies. And so here you have a passage that brings, you know, drinking, drunkenness, and voyeurism together. I'm not convinced of that. I'm not sure that there's necessarily anything wrong when it says Ham saw the nakedness of his father. He may have just been going into the tent to talk to his dad, and, you know, there his dad is, uncovered. I think the problem is what he does when he sees his father. I think the problem is he dishonors his father by telling his brothers. Now, we don't know what attitude he had in telling his brothers. We don't know if he was making fun of his dad or not. There's nothing of that hinted at in this text. But if Noah was drunk, and he is laying uncovered in his tent, why didn't Ham just privately cover up his dad? I think it's the dishonoring of the father by making this public to his two other brothers that is the problem. And you can tell by the actions of the brothers how they respond. They take a garment, lay it on both of their shoulders, and go backward and cover the nakedness of their father. Their faces were turned away. They did not see the nakedness of their father. You could argue from that that there is something bad about him seeing the nakedness of his father. And it is true in the Old Testament that there is sort of an aversion to nakedness in some ways. So the priests have to wear a special garment so that when they step up on the altar, their legs don't show. So you might be able, you could argue that there's this aversion to nakedness, and maybe there's something wrong with Ham seeing the nakedness of his father. But I really, as I read this text, it's the dishonoring of the father through telling the brothers what has happened. Well, Noah, yes.
It's clear in verse 24 that Noah's upset at what his son had done to him.
Yes.
But then my next question is, does the punishment fit the crime?
We're getting to that. Yes. Yeah, verse 24, Noah woke from his wine, knew what his younger son had done to him, came to the realization, the word know, what his younger son had done to him. We don't know how he came to that realization. Did some of the brothers tell him? But Noah wakes up and comes to the realization what had happened. Then he offers a curse. The curse is not on him, the son who had committed the deed. The curse is on Ham's son, Canaan. Verse 25, cursed be Canaan, a servant of servants he shall be to his brothers. Now, why is Canaan cursed and not Ham? That's a good question. God had already blessed Ham in chapter 9, verse 1. Does that mean he couldn't turn around and curse Ham? Many times in the Old Testament, curses and blessings do fall on descendants. This is not unusual at all for a curse or a blessing to fall on descendants. So it's something that's very common. I don't know if it fully answers our question as to why Canaan is cursed and not him. The curse of Canaan is that he will be a servant of servants to his brothers, brethren or brothers. This curse is carried out when the Israelites go into the land of Canaan and exterminate the Canaanites. This curse has nothing to do with slavery, as there have even been some in our own tradition that have made that connection. This curse is carried out when the children of Israel go into the land of Canaan. Now, is the curse greater than the crime, I guess, was your other question. That's a good question. By whose standard, I guess? Very serious in that culture to dishonor the father. That's a factor in sort of wrestling with how this thing all works out. Yes, sir. Yes, I think.
The fact that Ham did something wrong, do you have any sense of it was explicit? There was an explicitly made known set of rights and wrongs at this point, or is it just sort of, it's written on your heart, we all understand what God expects of us?
Yeah, that's a good question. We don't know specific details. It's going to be said about Abraham, however, that he walked in all the statutes, ordinances, and judgments or whatever, which are the same words used in Deuteronomy to refer to the law. So there's probably more revealed and passed down than we would think, but certainly one of the benefits of the Mosaic Covenant is a very detailed revelation of what God requires. So we don't have specifics, but certainly I think the basics of right and wrong are probably understood, and cultures have developed, and you develop things in culture, relationship to parents, and all those kinds of things. So I think probably that is a part of what's going on. Did you want to follow up or?
Because of sort of prophet status he has, or how did that work?
Perhaps as father? That's my first.
Sort of, I hope that.
Well, he's on the godly line. He's already been mentioned in chapter 5 of being prominent. He is the one who found grace in the eyes of God and whose family came through the flood. So if anybody at this time would have the ability to stand up and offer something like this, it would be Noah because of his leadership up to this point. Yes, sir.
It's going to be one of the Ten Commandments, the God's honor your father and your mother. It's going to be a requirement that God gives to the men of Israel in Deuteronomy to train up and to teach their children. God's going to make a special point later on in the Old Testament with the Rechabites in the sense of how they continue generation after generation after generation to honor their father. There are going to be a number of special points made about the dishonoring, and there's going to be a principle that runs counter to the American mindset right now, which is that when we sin, it does have an effect on others, and especially if we're the head of a household, it has effect on others. There isn't this concept of a private sin. And then finally, with the papers that everybody's going to do, when you get to Exodus 21 and following, you start getting into a lot of specific rules and laws that are pretty harsh in the sense of the lack of honoring of the father and mother, especially, for example, when a mother and father have to come before the priest and say, "We can't control our son," and look at the penalty. Wow, so maybe this isn't so harsh.
Yeah, your point is maybe we don't understand the significance of the dishonoring of the father here, which is sort of reinforced throughout the rest of the Old Testament. Just one other thing, moving beyond the curse of Canaan. You have this passage I'm blessed. There's a blessing connected now, a cursing and a blessing. We're going to run into that when we come to covenants especially. But blessed be the Lord, the God of Shem. And Shem is going to be the godly line, where the godly line goes through. May Canaan be a servant. May God enlarge Japheth. Now, we're going to see that the ancestors of Japheth settle in the area of Greece, Anatolia. And some people refer, may God enlarge Japheth. May he, who is he? That's the question. I think your translation read, may Japheth dwell in the tents of Shem. Is that correct? That's what your translation read. And that's possible. May Japheth dwell in the tents of Shem. And some people will connect that to the Apostle Paul taking the gospel into Asia Minor as a fulfillment of the good news coming through the line of Shem now to the nations, and especially Japheth. That's sort of the way I take it. Others try to argue, and there may be some possibility here, may he dwell in the tents of Shem, referring to God, and try to make some messianic connection here, which may be possible. Kaiser argues that particular view, but the connection with the Apostle Paul and the gospel going to Asia Minor, I think, is a good and interesting connection. All right, we come to chapter 10, 1 through 11, 9. Another toledot of Shem, Ham, and Japheth. The theme of this toledot, the rebellion of the nations against God, leading to confusion and dispersion, shows the need for God to form a new nation to accomplish his purposes. So it's going to be through this toledot and the incident at the Tower of Babel that God is, in essence, going to, how do you want to put this, change direction. Without under meaning, you know, meaning that in the right sense, he's going to focus on one individual that will develop from there. But this section begins with Noah's sons, and then expands to include all the nations. The purpose of this chapter is sort of laid out in chapter 10, verse 32. These were the families of the sons of Noah, according to their generations in their nations, and from these the nations were divided on the earth after the flood. The genealogy begins with Japheth, chapter 10, verses 2 through 5. Then Ham is dealt with in chapter 10, 6 through 20. And if you read any commentaries, you'll find out that we've already mentioned this. Japheth's descendants, the area that becomes Greece, Anatolia. Ham's descendants, interestingly enough, are those nations that interact with Israel. The nation of Israel more throughout her history, and some of them are her bitter enemies. And so some of Ham's descendants, not only the Canaanites, but Babylon, Assyria, Egypt, they're all a part of the descendants of Ham. Shem's line begins in verse 21. And there's basically, you have Shem's line in 21 through 31. That's one aspect of it. And then at the end of this chapter, you have a summary statement. And then you have the Tower of Babel incident, chapter 11, 1 through 9. And then Shem's line is picked up again in chapter 11, verse 10. And that's going to take you to Abraham. So that's sort of how it is... It is laid out. we come to the Tower of Babel incident. And you have the whole earth being of one language and one speech. Verse 3, they say to one another, come, let us make bricks and bake them thoroughly. They have brick for stone, asphalt for mortar. Let us build ourselves a city and a tower whose top is in the heavens. Let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be scattered abroad over the face of the whole earth. The Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the sons of men had built. And the Lord said, indeed, the people are one. They have all one language. And nothing that they propose to do will be withheld from them. Let us go down and confuse the language that they may not understand one another's speech. So the Lord scattered them abroad over the face of the whole earth. Therefore its name is called Babel, because there the Lord confused the language of all the earth, and from there the Lord scattered them abroad over the face of the earth. Now, you have the non-elect trying to make a name for themselves, the ungodly line, if you will. That's part of their purpose. They want to make a name for themselves, and instead of being fruitful, multiplying, and filling the earth, they have all gathered together in one place. They refuse to obey the Lord, and they try to make a name for themselves by building a tower. Now, there's some debate over what this tower is, but notice it says, verse 4, let us build ourselves a city and a tower whose top is in the heavens. Now, you don't necessarily have to think of a Jack and the Beanstalk kind of thing, something that goes way, 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 way up into heaven. It's not necessarily the concept. This tower may have been what some have called a ziggurat. This would be an example of a ziggurat, sort of a staircase structure that is a tower. Now these, and we don't really know exactly, some don't think that ziggurats were around this early. That's part of the debate. But ziggurats got connected. They got connected to temples. So this would be a picture of a temple complex with a ziggurat. And, you know, notice the stairs here. And what they would do is they would paint the top of the ziggurat blue, so that it sort of blended in with the sky. And that was considered to be the place where heaven and earth met, where the gods would come down and meet humanity. And so when they talk about building a tower into the heavens, you don't have to try to think of some technological marvel like the Empire State Building or something that goes way, 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 way up into heaven. It's just a concept. They're going to build a tower, and that tower represents the coming together of the realm of the gods and the realm of humanity. And this is would probably be something much later than what we read about in Genesis chapter 11. Some argue that this tower in Genesis 11 may have only been some kind of fortified tower, and not a full-fledged ziggurat. Yeah, you get archaeology and all that kind of thrown in there that we don't need to necessarily get into. But the purpose is to make a name for themselves, to build this tower that would intersect with the world of the gods. Now, you can see sort of the futility of their actions. The tower is so tiny that God has to come down to see it. Okay. The Lord came down, it says in verse 5, to see the city and the tower. And there's an Akkadian word, Babaloo. I know somebody's thinking what I'm thinking. Ricky Ricardo. Didn't he used to say Babaloo? Am I not correct there? Those of my generation, do you remember that? Pardon? Well, the Akkadian Babalu meant gate of the gods. And some people think the narrator here, Parades, or Moses, parodies that name with another name, Babel. Babel, meaning confusion. So that's an interesting suggestion. I told you that just so I could get in Babalu. It's interesting that the Babylonian creation myth has Babylon founded at the time of the original creation. But in the scriptural account, this is related to Babylon. It probably is. Babylon comes much later, or is mentioned much later. So there may be a little bit of a polemic going on here as well. Certainly, part of the modern day meaning would be technology. If this is really what's going on here in this tower, if this is some kind of, in that day, it may be some kind of newer technology. It mentions asphalt and stone, asphalt for mortar. Technology can be used by humans in a good way to subdue the world, but it can also be used by humans in a bad way in dishonoring God. And here they assert their autonomy, want to make a name for themselves, and disregard what God had told them to do. Some people would argue that Pentecost is sort of a reversal of the whole confusion of languages. On the day of Pentecost, you've got people that speak different languages, but they understand each other through that event. Well, following the Tower of Babel account, you have the other line of Shem picked up. The line that goes through Peleg and that leads to Terah and Abraham. Now, if you paid close attention to chapter 10, if you've read chapter 10 already, you might have noticed something very interesting, unusual. As you read through chapter 10, for example, an example of this would be verse 5. From these, the coastland peoples of the Gentiles were separated into their lands, everyone according to his language, according to their families, into their nations. So the genealogy in chapter 10 already specifies that these nations are spread out according to their language. Yet it's chapter 11 that tells us about the Tower of Babel incident. So what's going on here? Well, there's a couple of ways to explain this. You can look at the spread of the nations in two ways. The spread of the nations to fill the earth can be looked at as God's blessing. Be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth. By placing chapter 10 before chapter 11, you have an account here of the spread of the nations that really falls under God's blessing. If you would have had chapter 11 and then chapter 10, the genealogy that talks about the nations would have come more under the concept of judgment. And so perhaps the reason chapter 10 comes before chapter 11 is to look at the genealogy of the nations as under God's blessing, and not under the judgment of the curse that comes from the Tower of Babel. The other way you might look at this is, we've seen in Genesis up to this point something that has been general, and then maybe something more specific is focused on. So in Genesis chapter 1, you've got creation in a more universal sense, but then in chapter 2, you've got a focus on picking up on some things that have happened related to day six, perhaps, and you've got a more detailed account of the creation of Adam and Eve. Some would say that Genesis 10 is that more universal, more generalized account, and then chapter 11 focuses on on sort of the rationale, how the nations were scattered according to their languages. So that's another way to sort of look at this. But the spread of the nations is a part of what God wanted people to do. And certainly chapter 10, I think, is seen in a very positive light. Yes, sir.
It's important for me.
Yes.
So specifically, languages are not a curse that we can become a blessing. It's not something that a crooked stick with the diversification of languages is not a crooked stick with which God will bring Himself glory through a multitude of tongues. It is something that He planned all along and was part of the multiplying of the earth. Under the blessed, the diversity of tongues is not it's kind of a way of hobbling people, but it's part of the original plan of.
I think because of the order of these chapters, you have you can make a much better case for that. Whereas if Babel came and then chapter 10, it would certainly look like the diversity of language was more related to a curse aspect. And there may be some of that now it may have practical implications for what you do, but either way, we are trying to redeem something that has been messed up by humanity. So even if there is a curse on something in Scripture, normally that can be overcome by those who are willing to submit themselves to God and do what God wants to do. So just because there's a curse connected here to it doesn't necessarily mean that forever it can't be overcome, I guess is what I'm trying to say. And I don't know all the practical implications of that, for what your interests are, but I always like to hold out the hope of the curses in Scripture. Many times can be Ruth, a Moabite. The Moabite shall not come into the assembly of the Lord for 10th generation. Here you got Ruth making a commitment to Yahweh. So that gives some hope, I think, for even if you're going to argue that the languages, the diversity of languages is sort of part of the curse. There's hope. Yes, sir.
What are you doing wrong here that God is trying to correct? I mean, when you read it, it almost has the sense that God is fearful of what they could accomplish. He doesn't give them own languages.
Well, they're being disobedient to what God told them to do. Fill the earth. And they're coming together in one place to make a name for themselves. I don't think there's any sense in this passage that God is concerned. I think he may be concerned about consequences and implications for the earth, but I don't think he's at all concerned about what they can do in light of his own plans and purposes. Yeah.
Yeah. Saying, like, when you read, and nothing that they've grown to do will now be impossible for them. Why is that a big deal? Because we would want to say, yeah, it's good for us to come together and accomplish great things.
Yeah. And there is a sense that community is good and building cities and civilization are not bad. And so there must be something more sinister going on here in terms of the numbers of people that want to come together to accomplish whatever it is they want to accomplish. And what that is, I don't know beyond what the text says. Yeah, motive is a big part of it. I mean, it's being disobedient to God. And we've already seen what happens before the flood when people are disobedient to God. The resultant wickedness. And so maybe that statement, nothing that they propose to be, maybe it's just referring to the bad things that can happen when people do, in large and great numbers, sort of throw off any vestige of God and who He is.
The preceding program has been brought to you by RTS on iTunes U at the virtual campus of Reformed Theological Seminary and may not be reproduced or disseminated in part or in whole for sale or for profit without express written consent. For information on how you may obtain a fully accredited Master of Arts in Religion degree online, please visit us at virtual.rts.edu.